Is everyone happy? Well, first of all, I'm very grateful for being here. Such a very, very beautiful place. And John, Venerable, thank you for taking such good care of it. It's really nice to see. Ajahn Chah used to say that the way to tell a good monastery is to check the toilets. So I checked the toilets, they're all nice and clean, so we're doing well. Ajahn Chah had a very practical, humorous, happy way of living. A very happy man. Just this kind of person, when you meet him, you think, I want to be like that. And whatever he's got, I want a little bit of it. I guess it was his utter confidence and yet lack of arrogance and this kind of utter joy in his heart and yet really very still, very calm. And these different factors that if he said anything, you really listened. And then why is he saying that? You really listened. And so, having a teacher is quite a lovely thing too, because if we're on our own and we're just functioning from our own views and opinions, then sometimes we can go astray because our own views and opinions are always limited. So there are so many teachers now. Dharma, you know, MP3s and books and retreats. So it's a very rich time. I suppose you get indigestion with so many teachers. Whereas when I started, there wasn't much around really. Jack Kerouac and things like that. So there's a tremendous amount of teaching. But I think you want to be careful not just to do kind of Buddhist entertainment. Like you could watch 2 hours of Buddhist YouTubes and think you've done something. And all you've just watched TV really. So the kind of taking some inspiring teachings and then internalizing them, that's a kind of it takes more effort, doesn't it? It takes more effort. So in picking up teachings, if you look at the difference between just feeling inspired and actually kind of feeling somewhat quizzical maybe. You say, what does that mean? How could I use that so that the Dharma becomes a kind of constant refrain in consciousness, a constant lens through which you look at life, a kind of constant reference point. The theme of the retreat, I don't know if I've really stuck with it, I rarely do. You get given these titles and you sort of just go for it, see how you feel. But selfless service, it's a lovely way to think about where you go back to now. Because sometimes you get the beautiful serenity of this place and this kind of natural environment and people living on precepts and great food and etc., etc. And then you go back into maybe a complex workplace with a boss who's an utter creep. Right? And so then you kind of think, I don't want to go there, I want to be here. Sure, that's true. But that holding on to this place and then creating the next place you're going as some kind of a negative thing, already is suffering, isn't it? So, in a sense, you have to let go of all the... You have to let go of this situation, but what can you hold? What can you take? Well, you can take a whole set of skills, hopefully, that we're all developing. You can take those and you can apply those anywhere. Whereas if you take experience, such as the experience of peace, or the experience of harmony, or the experience of beauty, that's very limited. That depends on conditions. And these kinds of conditions are like very, very extraordinary. Very extraordinary that we can come together like this. And ordinary life isn't so organized or peaceful or calm. And so ordinary life is more coarse. You know, it's a more coarse situation. And so one of the dangers of meditative life is an attachment to refinement, where refinement is a helpful thing. Like samadhi is a very refined state of mind, learning to calm the mind, it's very important. But then if we attach to that refinement, when we come to coarseness, loud noise, people who are marginally obnoxious or hugely obnoxious, or situations which aren't maybe terribly moral, you know, all these kinds of things which we face, then we begin to hate the world and kind of blame it on the world. But if we go with that idea of service, how can I make this a better planet? How can I make my family a better place? How can I make people cough less or whatever? I got my drops too if you want. So it's an attitude of giving, isn't it? You know, going into, rather than getting. And I've certainly seen that in monastic life, where sometimes you get some person comes in and they already have a kind of pretty set viewpoint of what Theravada Buddhism is and how monasteries should be. And they come to the monastery with an idea of getting something, getting tranquility, getting insight, getting attainment, getting their own space, doing their own practice. And they're an absolute misery to themselves and others, because their whole attitude is what, you know, how can I score from this place for myself? How can I extract as much happiness for myself? And they couch it all in very clever Pali language. You know, they use the Pali language of, you know, monks are supposed to go off to the root of a tree and meditate, so you guys wash your dishes and I'll go meditate, or whatever. And that mindset usually has no sense of devotion. It doesn't have a sense of humility. It has a kind of, you know, it's a kind of holds to very strong views. Whereas what I've noticed with monks who come into monastery with a sense of, well, how can I help the abbot? How can I make this a better place? How can I serve the community? Their meditation goes better, and much happier people, and much nicer to be around. Yeah? And so just that whole attitude that we face the world's problems is very, very important. Not that we like problems, but life is complicated, things do come up. The ideas around generosity and morality, the way morality is sometimes talked about, is that by not harming living beings, I give the gift of non-oppression to many, many living beings, and I receive the gift of non-oppression. By not stealing from living beings, I give them the gift of non-oppression. I give the gift of, and it's a lovely way to think about it, isn't it? By living by the moral precepts, it's a gift to other beings, and then it becomes a gift to myself. Rather than morality seen as some kind of a repression or some kind of simply moral ideology. And I've learned my Buddhism as a monk, and I didn't even know how to meditate when I became a monk. I just went for it. And what has been, and so I can only reflect from that place really. But what's been more helpful for me is that I have a structure which I can give up to. So I have a Vinaya structure, I live in a hierarchy, I have my monastic responsibilities, and that structure it seems very tight. When you look at the rules, it seems pretty tight. But what I discovered was that by giving up to these rules, etiquettes, protocols, a way of relating and so on, by surrendering to that, living with that, within that, I had the freedom to watch my mind. And that's kind of surprised me. It wasn't the freedom, because before I went into the monastery, I had been traveling around Europe and North Africa and Middle East and, you know, the whole thing which one did in those days, India and so on. And so there was the freedom to do what I wanted to do, but I wasn't happy. My mind wasn't calm or composed. It was quite distracted. And then this huge flip into monastic life, and all of a sudden, all those avenues were no longer there, be it food or music or whatever. And then there was a kind of feeling of being obviously very contained by this. And then that insight came, yeah, but this is a chance to watch the very feeling of suffering. Yeah, and then picking up Ajahn Chah's theme, that his method is frustration, and so this kind of freedom in a social structure to watch like and dislike, to watch love and hate, to watch the feeling of being fed up and wanting to leave, all those different feelings, and just taking the standard as awareness and just coming back to that standard. Yeah, this is what it feels like to be totally fed up. Right? And what's the option? Disrobe or understand what's going on in the mind. And just coming back to that most important kind of pinnacle of our practice is, this is what it feels like now. This is what boredom feels like. This is what doubt feels like. It just feels this way now. I began to see that in that knowing, I had a freedom that was not dependent on me being excited or interested or inspired. You know, it was different than that. And that's the freedom of a spiritual life. It's not the freedom of the worldly life. The freedom of the worldly life is like having lots of money and doing what you want to do. Right? But that's not a real freedom. It's a kind of enslavement to sense realms. So in lay life, the Buddha couldn't, the Buddha didn't set out rules like you have in the Quran or in the Torah. You know, he didn't set out rules like that for lay people. He set out just kind of very general principles of mutual responsibility. So the responsibility of a parent to a child and a child to a parent. Responsibility of a husband to wife and wife to husband. Responsibility of employer to employee and employee to employer. And he set up a kind of a very interesting system of responsibility rather than rights. Rights are necessary. Human rights are very necessary because much of humanity isn't going to listen to responsibility. So human rights are very, very important. But the kind of sense that like the social structures that the Buddha favored were ones that we gave to our situation in the way of responsibility. The responsibility of a junior monk to a senior monk to a junior monk. So it's always been both ways. Responsibility of a father to his child, but the child to the father. Responsibility of teacher to student, but student to teacher. Never just one way, never one way. And that only makes sense, doesn't it? It's the only way it could really, really work. But so the whole sense of it, then within that responsibility, one tries to serve and one tries to develop the paramitas, the virtuous qualities. Work in Buddhism, there's the aspect of work which is to be able to put food on the table and to pay for the mortgage. There's the aspect of developing the skill of work in whatever field one works. And there's the aspect of human relationship where we develop a heart which has the capacity to be broadly compassionate and patient. All three are a part of, say, right livelihood in a Buddhist culture. And so when we bring these attitudes of Dharma practice into our responsibilities, we bring the attitude of, what can I do now to make this a better situation? I've seen like monks, they're very, very gifted men, come to the monastery and they stay maybe 5 or 6 years and they start to get disgruntled because it's not perfect. Yeah. Welcome to life, right? You guys don't have the chanting. So I'd say, well, why don't you just stay and make it better? You know, you're talented, God, we need you. Why don't you stay and make it better? And off they go. Thanks a lot. And they have all the opinions why it's wrong. I know it's wrong. I'm doing my best, that kind of thing. And so but then when I see them later on, you can see there's a kind of sadness in them. Not that disrobing's bad or wrong, but it's such a beautiful life that oftentimes that leaving for that kind of reason, from that kind of disgruntled mind, you see, well, the result isn't that happy. You could sense in a lot of monks who have disrobed, there's a kind of sadness there that maybe it would have been better to contribute to the deficiencies rather than to judge them. So when the heart has these kinds of very deep open-hearted attitudes, the whole way we relate to each other becomes much more meaningful, much more beautiful, and it becomes a way where we need a lot less personally. So I think we've all seen when we start to open the heart and abide with feelings of friendship and generosity and gratitude, these very profound states of mind, the more we do that, the more actually we are fulfilled, and our need for external compensations and external things becomes less and less and less. And as our inner need becomes less, we can actually give more. This is the kind of marvelous thing about it. To idealize the way of the heart, like I should be generous and I should be dutiful and all that, usually actually leads to burnout. And you can certainly become very idealistic and reach a state of burnout, but that's not meditation practice. That's usually a kind of repressed idea that I should help my mother, I should help my father, I should like my kids, and so on and so forth. That's not Dharma practice. It's the kind of tyranny of ideology. And we have ideas and we grasp ideals in our own minds, which then we use oftentimes to beat ourselves up. I certainly have, I'm sure you have. You know, we have ideals of compassion and generosity, and then the reality is we just feel crappy. And we don't want to give. And thank you very much, you know, go make your own sandwich and whatever it is. And so not to deny that, you know, not to deny that, because you have to be very honest about that, to awaken to that, but then not to take that path, not to take the path of negativity. So it's interesting when you awaken to feelings like of exhaustion. Like with my mother, I cut off and feel very exhausted, you know, just really, really tired. And then I just watch the exhaustion. With exhaustion as condition, what would come? Oh my gosh, how much longer? And then I'd read, like, both of us would read, someone lives to be 106. We'd both say, oh my gosh, this is just too far. Because we're both exhausted, you know, we kind of run the race. But then I know if I just I made conscious the feeling of exhaustion, and I say, what am I creating around that now? What am I adding to the feeling of exhaustion? Then I thought, I'm projecting into the future, right? I can't do this, or I'm going to have to, and I had to, like functionally, I had to make sure I had people to help me and so on, not denying that part, but just a very human feeling of say, sickness or exhaustion, they're just this way. And then what do we create on top of them? You know, what do I add to that? A kind of horrific future that this will always be like this, or it will get less, worse and worse and worse. But I found if I I did a lot of sitting. I think that's very important. I was religious with my meditation, morning and evening at least. I made sure I sat a good hour at least in both ends, and that was very helpful, just to kind of get into contact with, okay, what's this this difficult time of giving, but beautiful time of giving, what is it producing in consciousness now? What is this day's activities? What has it produced in consciousness? And then through the sitting practice, and that's where the sitting practice is so revealing, isn't it? Where you sit down and you notice, whoa, look at that, you're feeling resentful, or you're feeling uptight, or whatever it is. And that, so it's like this kind of clarity on the moods of the mind which have been produced in the day. And then it also, because one is aware of the mood structures that are manifesting in mind, then it also is a way to not believe in them and let them fade away. So there's a kind of both awakening and clearing away, awakening and clearing away. As I was saying, suggesting, like in the mornings, to really awaken to the mood of the mind. That I find very helpful. Just what is the dream state producing? Yeah? And sometimes I'd wake up with a really frightening dream. Yeah? But this is fear. I just feel it in my body. Go to the heart. I usually, when I wake up, I try to, first thing I go here. That's what I try to do. Rather than my emails. Much better place. So, go here. What's it saying to this morning? Where are you at? And it's very, very edifying. It's really, really interesting. And so that if the night's sleep had produced fearful states, then that's what the day was starting with, some mode of anxiety around healthcare issues or whatever. Then sit with that, and then sit with that, and just let it go, let it go. Come back to a sense of balance. And this is the idea of craft. Craft is, if you've ever done any, like you imagine, just think about it. Laminating all these beams. I was looking at these beams. What have they got? Like, you know, they're like 10 deep, 2 inches. Can you imagine glue that much was? Each one, huh? Each one they set out, they must have set them out in the concrete down below. They set it out in pins. They bent them, and then they glued them all up, and they laminate them. I mean, I don't know how many beams there are here, right? You imagine how much patience that takes? And that's craft. You know, craft isn't like these beautiful vases. The person that made that vase didn't just one day just go, boop, sheep. They probably spent 30 years before they could make that gorgeous shape. Right? And that aspect of craft is also the aspect of meditation. You just plug away at it. Right? You just, morning sitting, if you want to meditate, meditate. If you don't want to meditate, meditate. Evening sitting, same thing. You just do it. Really, it's not about, if you only meditate when you want to meditate, you know, what are you going to get? 2 days out of the month? But it's those very, you know, those very times when you just feel, oh, I can't meditate, I'm too tired. Where you meditate, you know, this is what tiredness feels like. And you get in touch with what the self, the I making, my making, that idea, what the I making, my making does around moods. Sickness is a very interesting one. Like I found like those early years in Thailand, when I felt sick, I'd always get homesick as well. You know, kind of, mom, give me some grapes or something. Here I am, I'm almost 30 or something, or 25. And this kind of lonely feelings would come up with sickness. I began to see, oh, with sickness as condition, there's this type of a sense of self comes up. This kind of psychological self comes up with sickness. And then I began to see, what's just sickness? Sickness feels this way. And then the creation of a self, I begin to let go of. And then there's more peace on it. Oh, just sickness feels this way. It doesn't feel nice, but it doesn't have all that addition. Tiredness, sickness, being fed up, or all these very human feelings we have, they can be much more transient if we awaken to them. Just, you know, learn how to awaken to them. And so the sitting practice is very helpful for that. And I've always found if my mind is really churning over something that I'm upset about, that's the best time to hit the cushion or the walking path. Now, walking in our forest tradition, walking meditation has always been much encouraged. Ajahn Chah encouraged us a lot. And I certainly found in those early years of meditation, I was so restless that I found sitting hard. I just would do a lot of walking practice. If I was really angry at someone, I just back and forth for a couple of hours. I just watch the energy. And rather than just trying to control your anger, very dumb, well, I just, no, let it run and just feel. I mean, I didn't punch the other monk, fortunately. But just, you know, feel the energy of the body. So sitting and walking are the kind of classic postures that we try to cultivate. And if you can develop a sitting, a walking path somewhere in your apartment or in your garden where people don't think you're a bit crazy, I can imagine you're walking back and forth and neighbors call the police. There would be a committee. But what we well, like as monastics, what we find is we have a kutti, a hut, and we have our meditation path. It's a very important part of the architecture of a monastery. And then, as you do sitting and walking, then when you hit the kind of walking path, you just kind of remember the practice. It's like hitting your cushion. You kind of remember. You remember. Oh yeah, this is about mindfulness. This is about centering. This is about presence. Now, one of the postures that two other postures kind of classically are standing and lying down. Now, lying down is a very dangerous posture because it usually leads to snoring, which isn't quite. But if you can develop a good lying posture for meditation, it's very useful because, you know, as you get older, your knees, you know, find difficult sitting or. So if you have a lot of energy but your body's a bit sore, do try lying meditation. Try to lay down. Try to find a posture that that you can hold for long periods of time. Usually, like classically, they suggest lying on your right side with your arm, like you see the statues of Buddha. I never found that worked for me. I lay down in on my back and I just put my hands on my thighs like that, and the way I've learned to develop that is to first of all make the intention that this is meditation now, it's not falling asleep, right? And then to take the posture quite deliberately, so I'm kind of just setting it up, balance, getting an equal amount of weight on both hips and getting the shoulders straight and so on, like setting it up so that the mind is in the framework of meditation, and then setting up the hands in some way. And then I found most helpful the determination not to move, because in my investigation of this I found that with the lying posture, when there was discomfort, my mind would go to the seeking of comfort, which was the seeking of sleep. If you think about when you lay down and you want to sleep, you kind of get into whatever posture and you're moving towards comfort and annihilation, basically. That's what you're trying to do. Whereas if you lay down and you take your posture and you make a determination not to move, you'll notice that pretty quick you feel discomfort. But you know darn well it's not going to hurt you. So then you take the discomfort as your object of awareness, the very discomfort. So maybe you feel, oh, I could have moved a little bit more on it. No, don't move. Just hold your mind on discomfort. Hold your mind on discomfort. And that brightens the mind. That sharpens the mind. And then you keep with the posture. And I think it's worthwhile kind of investigating that posture, trying to develop that. And if you do it rigorously, you can get very peaceful meditations in that way. But you have to, most people will kind of, I mean, I don't do yoga classes, but I imagine when they do the corpse posture in yoga, there must be some serious snoring goes on. I don't know. I just can't imagine what else it would be. But try to get postures and places in your home where you are reminded of formal meditation practice. Very profitable. So I don't know how you feel about iconography. I love iconography. But a shrine is nice, a place that associates you with stillness rather than just any old space. And like doing things like the way we're trained is we have a shrine in our kuti, And when we come into our kutta, we bow to the shrine, pay respect to the shrine, as a way of mindfulness. And things like that, rituals like that, where you have a shrine and before you meditate, you bow three times, if you like bowing, you don't have to, but you bow three times, you light the candles, you look at the Buddha image, you look at the flowers. All of those, if they're done day in and day out, they become a really, really good entry into your meditation practice. They're all very, very skillful. And then that space that you have, that corner of the room that you have, has this lovely kind of vibe about it. It has that vibe of meditation. So you're kind of creating situations for formal practice. I think most lay people find, many lay people I talk to, the discipline of actually doing formal sitting practice at home, one of the more difficult disciplines, because it doesn't seem like you're doing anything. Like to answer your emails or to cook up some spaghetti or to make a shelf or to clean the house, it seems very productive. And there's always too much we need to do. We never have enough time to do it all. So just kind of stopping and sitting down and being becomes something you have to be quite determined to do. Quite determined. It's very, try to make it very, very important, because it's in that stopping that you first of all, you're entering into the more spiritual aspects of the psyche, and you're noticing the churning of the worldly mind, the churning that goes on. So having finished your retreat, been much too short, I'm just kind of figured out where I am. Just getting into my stride, as it were. But anyway, having finished the retreat, you have a bit of momentum, don't you? You know, you've been diligently practicing and putting a lot of effort forth. Try to carry that momentum into your sitting practice. And then try to make determinations where you sit a certain amount of time. If you can sit morning and evening, let's say you only sit once, maybe you sit half an hour or 45 minutes in the morning. Even if you can sit and stop for 5 minutes in the evening, just that, just to stop, just to bring the mind to the sense of stopping is very valuable, very valuable. And that sense of stopping, which I talked about a lot, I think, that the way I suggested starting a meditation, where you awaken and you listen, and you listen, and what does the listening do? You put down thought, you stop. You come to stopping, stopping, stopping. Not repressing, not getting rid of, but stopping into the moment. And it's that stopping that is very difficult to do because we're so busy in our culture. There's always so much to do and so many interesting things to do. It's not that they're immoral. It's, you know, just there's so much to do. And so that the capacity to stop is probably more difficult in our complex societies, or in our kind of excited society. But if you can get to places in your life, morning and evening, or even if you can just sort of put the computer on sleep mode and the boss isn't watching and just meditate for 5 minutes and stop. I know it's not always possible, but those bits of stopping bring great power to the mind. And you begin to remember the very nature of stopping. You know, you begin to be in the dental office and the mind is looking at the good housekeeping or whatever they have, and you say, no, I'll just listen. Or you're in a queue at the grocery store and you're thinking, oh, there's 10 people in the queue, is there a smaller queue? No, I'll take the 10 people, thank you. And I'll just be present. And I'll use the 10 people actually as a way of just being present and stopping. And you kind of introduce this kind of practice of just stopping, stopping, stopping more and more into your life. And you're still productive. You still do what you have to do. But that, I think, is very powerful, very powerful. And then you begin to really appreciate those moments of stopping. They become more and more constant in your life, more and more available in your life, more and more apparent. You begin to see the beauty of that. And as you appreciate the beauty of stopping, then the need to do all the time becomes kind of coarse. some of the, you need to do things functionally, but some of the doing that we do is just habit, isn't it? We're just running around. And the stopping of the mind brings you to the beauty of the mind, the beauty of silence, the beauty of the open heart. Very lovely, lovely possibilities for human birth. If you can, do lots of retreats. If you can get time off work, if you have the resource to do that, retreats are very, very helpful. Try to do some study. Study is like take the Four Noble Truths and try to memorize the basic structure of Four Noble Truths. That's very, very helpful. But don't keep Buddhism as just an intellectual thing. Make it of the heart. Try to integrate the intellectual understanding as a kind of, like I've been saying, a reflective vehicle. So when you read something which strikes you as interesting, see how you can make that conscious in ordinary life, in the way, whatever way you're living. To bring up like devotional qualities or heart qualities, it's very good to, like, on the 22nd, my mother died on the 22nd of September, and we had a big dana for her. And a lot of the old-time people that I knew from Wellington were there. That was great. And they all asked, what food did your mother like? Pickled herring. Pickled herring? When are we going to get that? Okay, apple strudel. Anyway, so the different people got different food, and we made a shrine, and we had four Kuan Yins and my mother, and then I invited other people. We'll just bring a picture of your mom or dad, put them on the shrine. And then there's a friend, his daughter had just died, Jessica, in a car accident, and we put her picture on, and then we dedicated the merits. And we had this meal together, potluck, and we dedicated the merits of this good activity to my mother and to all these other people we were thinking of. And those are very practical, ritualized ways of opening the heart and expressing gratitude. And if we don't, I mean, it's not that we don't feel grateful. It's not a matter of not feeling grateful. It's maybe sometimes just doing specific things to keep making it conscious. Make gratitude conscious. And that's a really lovely way to open your meditation. I do that a lot with my teachers. I see the picture of my teachers on the shrine and my mom and dad and so on, and then I look and I just bring up this sense of thank you. And then that prepares the meditation for, you know, from the heart rather than from the head. And again, that's all part of just the little things of life, just the little activities of the craft of the heart. And they do add up. Amazing how they add up to a very good practice. So I think I've sort of probably said enough. Does anyone have any comments or anything or questions, or have we covered the whole planet? Or Ajahn, you want to mention anything to them? Any business or?
Yeah, just to express on behalf of the committee and board directors, Aboriginal people, or owners of this land, and all the beings in the forest, to express our deep gratitude and appreciation for your presence, Ajahn, and your teachings, your skillful means. Yeah, that's great. We hope you, whenever you stop by, yeah, to the Southern Hemisphere,
okay,
think about Buddha Dhamma.
I'll give it a go. All right. I will abide, pervading one quarter with a heart imbued with loving kindness. Likewise the second, likewise the third, likewise the fourth. So above and below, around and everywhere, and to all as to myself. I will abide, pervading the all-encompassing world, with a heart imbued with loving-kindness, abundant, exalted, immeasurable, without hostility and without ill will. I will abide, pervading one quarter, with a heart imbued with compassion, likewise the second, likewise the third, likewise the fourth. So above and below, around and everywhere, and to all as to myself, I will abide, pervading the all-encompassing world, with a heart imbued with compassion, abundant, exalted, immeasurable, without hostility and without ill will. I will abide, pervading one quarter with a heart endued with gladness, likewise the second, likewise the third, likewise the fourth. So above and below, around and everywhere, and to all as to myself, I will abide, pervading the all-encompassing world, with a heart imbued with gladness, abundant, exalted, immeasurable, without hostility and without ill will. I will abide, pervading one quarter, with a heart imbued with equanimity, likewise the second, likewise the third, likewise the fourth, so above and below, around and everywhere, and to all as to myself, I will abide, pervading the all-encompassing world, with a heart imbued with equanimity, abundant, exalted, immeasurable, without hostility and without ill will. And let's pay respects to the Triple Gem. Finish.
Arahanga Sama Sambuddho Bhagava Buddhang Bhagavanta Abhivate Sakato Pando Bhagavato Sāvaka Sangho